You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls and the Internet. I'm KMO. You are tuned in to Sea Realm Radio, which for some of you might take the form of a podcast. And today is the 1st of October. It is beautiful and sunny, but jacket weather has arrived, and I'm sure a lot of you are like me in that you're ready to welcome it. It's been a hot summer, and the heat has continued longer than I would like. Anyway, that's possibly a topic for another show. I think we're going to be more maybe techno-utopian, at least slightly more optimistic than, say, the hour of radio that you just heard, which was Radio EcoShock. Jamie, are you there?
I am.
You are. Say a few words so I can get your volume levels right.
My name's Jamie, and while I would say from the heat perspective, I'm enjoying the warm days and cool nights that this fall is giving us so far.
Well, I'm speaking from Vermont, but you are north of here.
I am. I'm about an hour south of Ottawa, Ontario, in Canada.
Alrighty, and are we just using a first name today?
Sure.
Okay. So, Jamie, you are at least at one time, you were a podcaster. How long did you do that show, and what was it?
I think I did that for close to 2 years. The title I had it under was Stepping Off the Edge, trying to look at a mix of things that are happening right now, that if you look at them in the micro scale and kind of extrapolate or hypothesize what that looks like with a future that's based on that, education, open source technology, and democracy things were kind of some of the main pillars to it. There were a couple Sea Realm guests that people might recognize. Douglas Rushkoff was one of the first one, but it has since gone away. I think there are some episodes out there on Podomatic, but I just caution any listeners who choose to listen. The audio quality was not nearly as good as Sea Realm, so your ears may bleed, and please don't hold me to that if that's the case.
Well, I listened to a few episodes and my ears never bled, so it's not nearly as bad as all that. Jimmy, you live on a farm, is that right?
Yes, I do.
It is the farm that I visited?
It is indeed.
So say a little bit about your past and your present ambitions as a farmer and maybe how they've changed.
When we moved here about almost a decade ago, very much had the idea of an intentional community coming together. We certainly have it as a hobby farm now with horses and chickens, but the difference between an intention and that manifesting into reality has not necessarily come about. So it's maybe the pendulum swung to where we're comfortable with it as hobby farm, but those lofty ideas and ambitions haven't come to reality. So it's not certain what the future may necessarily hold, but it's seeing what the rest of reality is doing. I shake my head sometimes at where we are now compared to where I thought we'd be, a decade ago.
Well, I'm sure that resonates with a lot of people on a lot of different topics. In fact, I like the way you phrased it. We're all sort of existing in the space between our ambition and the manifestations of those ambitions, including, high-achieving people like Elon Musk. And you had sent me a link to a video by Elon Musk. I watched it this morning, and I even ripped the audio thinking I might play a few clips from it. But Elon Musk is definitely a very smart man, but he's not a good speaker. There was not a single clip that I could play that would be at all engaging or entertaining. So, what was it about that video? What was it about, and what was the topic, and what was it that captured your imagination about that?
So I don't know the exact event, but it was a little bit of his vision for the next 5 to 10 years, whether that's SpaceX-driven goals to get to Mars and digging into some of the technology, whether they've used it in their current rocketry or prototype pieces of it, like their new engines for what they framed as the big effing rocket, that it will both try to get them to Mars and to the moon, and even be used as a Earth-to-Earth transit by going to sort of suborbital flight. And what really struck me in the initial part of that was watching some of the animations that were in it reminded me back of some of the old, not online games, but it was sort of computer to computer. One of them that I think you and I had maybe both played was called Master of Orion.
Yes.
And the notion there was like the idea of the tech tree. And what he was showing was, here's the five steps we can go through. And sure, they're very optimistic and may not come to be, but it, you could see how they were investing in different parts of that tech tree to try and create the future that they wanted using that.
So in old science fiction, like maybe not Buck Rogers, but you know, things about that era, if we saw a rocket ship take off from the Earth, you know, it looked like it was recognizable as a rocket, you know, a cylinder with a pointed end and, you know, flames coming out the other side. And it would fly up off the Earth as, you know, we see rockets do. But then when it got to its destination, it would flip around and land tail first, you know, just using the rocket thrust to slow it down and maybe attitude jets to position it to keep it from falling over. And that just looked really unrealistic to my eyes. It seemed like that was, you know, where the imaginations of the creators of these science fiction visions were falling down. But that's exactly what Elon Musk's SpaceX has set out to do. And they have landed, I think, 16 of them in that fashion, often on barges or platforms floating out on water. And, well, without a single mishap, you know, in 16 landings. They have had mishaps. They have had spectacular explosions, you know, upon touchdown and other failures. But they have a long winning streak going right now. So he's not just, you know, pointing to slides up on a screen and saying this is what we plan to do. I mean, they have a quite impressive track record in terms of what they have been able to manifest. Jamie, are you there?
Yeah,
oh, there you are. Go ahead.
I am. It is... the contrast that I see in, you know, not obviously not just Elon Musk, but all of SpaceX and all of the resources that they're working with to make those successes happen. And the contrast to looking at sort of what like U.S. government policy is managing to do or not do in regards to healthcare, just as a small example of the rate of technological change. One of the examples in that video they talked about was that it's been 9 years since the first launch of any of the SpaceX rockets, and what they've been able to achieve in that 9 years and what they're planning to look at and achieve in the next 5 years, sort of maybe being that idea of the exponential growth of technology. But what strikes me is that it's not a case where access to that technology is evenly distributed, and it really, it sort of got me thinking about the idea of how do we either distribute that access fairly, or what can we do as sort of larger society that raises all boats, if you will.
Well, I am not an Elon Musk aficionado, so I don't know his positions on everything, but I haven't heard him say anything which seems to indicate that he's any great critic of capitalism. And I think it's pretty clear, even to people who are great, you know, boosters of capitalism, that equal distribution, or you know, equitable distribution of goods and services and wealth, is not its major selling point. You know, it's not something that even its most ardent boosters really put forward as you know, a realistic benefit of capitalism.
Yeah, and that's where sort of I'm left wondering if, you know, go back to the Industrial Revolution up to today, in various different iterations, it's primarily been a capitalist-driven society with government, or whatever you want to sort of frame the other narratives under. Is it time for something else? And what do you think that sort of other or something else or the next iteration might look like? And one of the neat maybe stepping points to that that I was listening to a recent podcast, I think it's Guy Raz for How It's Made, or sorry, How I Built This, was interviewing the guys behind Kickstarter. And that's been around for 15, maybe years now. It's an example of giving individuals the opportunity to vote with their dollars for individual projects they might like to see come into reality. And they certainly get, you know, Kickstarter backer benefits or swag that come along with sort of investing in those. But to me, it's a really good example that I like to touch on between those two types of future realities, because it's a case where it's not based on geographic representation for someone else to believe or try and total up what all of my interests are or those of the geographic community. I can individually say, I'd like to sponsor that product or, you know, that initiative or that type of thing. And it'd be interesting to see if government was a little bit more of a crowdsource structure in that regard to, you know, everybody has many different opinions in regards to the things they want to support. But right now, it doesn't seem like that's an achievable way to vocalize your opinion through government.
Well, I'd like to talk about maybe using games and the technology and the experience that we have from playing games, you know, computer games, to bootstrap democracy, you know, so-called democracy, into something much more closely resembling actual democracy. But before we go there, I just want to say something about Kickstarter. I've used Kickstarter successfully twice, once to fund the publication of a book, and the second time to fund a tour. And it's great. You know, it is versatile. You can raise money for a lot of different things, but it's also sort of a workaround to difficulties that the U.S. federal government has placed in the path of would-be small business entrepreneurs, in that there are very strict rules about how you can solicit people to invest in your nascent business. And these rules are supposedly there to protect people from fraud, you know, to protect people from fraudsters who would go around saying, hey, I've got this killer business idea. You know, I'm soliciting startup capital now. And, you know, whatever you invest, you know, conservatively will be returned 100-1, which, you know, is pie in the sky talk, even for, you know, really viable businesses. But a lot of people, you know, there's a temptation to want to be able to jump in on the ground floor and make a killing. You know, who doesn't wish that they had purchased a whole bunch of Bitcoin when it was 10 cents per coin? But at the same time, it is perfectly legal to fly to Las Vegas, to gamble away all your money, and then to take out a second mortgage on your house right there at the casino and gamble that away as well. And, you know, if the federal government was really all that concerned about, you know, keeping fools and their money together, that wouldn't be legal. So, you know, the fact that we need something like Kickstarter, it seems to bespeak a real problem with representative democracy, because the structures of so-called democratic governmental power aren't very democratic. They seem to be heavily in favor, or, you know, they seem to be tilted toward those with a lot of money and a lot of capital.
Yeah, and a lot of influence, too, based on their proximity to power, that certainly in my own case, and I think a lot of people, they don't feel that they have that close a position to be able to say, you know, I feel strongly about this. We don't have a lot of good tools to be able to say how many other people feel the same way as you do to help set the agenda for that federal government.
So before we start talking about video games, just say a little bit about yourself professionally off the farm. What's your relationship to technology? Let's start there.
My relation to technology is that it's been a fairly consistent part of my life. I've been a web developer for close to two decades now, I guess. Most of the work that I do is with the open source content management system WordPress. It's a PHP platform, apparently from stats, now they say upwards of 25 to 28% of all websites on the internet are powered by it. And it kind of has gone through periods where, I mean, its origin was as a blogging platform. So it was purely about allowing people to share their message. And one of the common terms that are taglines to it is that it's trying to democratize publishing. It's also become a platform that small businesses have found very useful to set up their own site, not necessarily having to have a lot of skill and technology to do, you know, a basic boutique site of who we are, what we sell, how to get in touch with us, and bring that blog piece on to let their interested customers know what's going on. It's grown to become much more of an application framework now. And so it's one of the reasons I am a strong advocate for open source and WordPress in particular as the open source platform I most develop with, is just the idea that while I may make a small contribution to that platform, there are tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of other people all working towards a common goal. We may slightly disagree on what does that sort of future state look like, but it's very easy, certainly if you have developer skill or even if you don't, to contribute to the things that you would like to see happen in that platform. And I think open source it's one of the best examples we have of collaborative development or collaborative work happening for public good. And it's interesting and probably ties back to some of the narratives we've been talking about earlier, where those open source tools are underlying technology for a vast number of capitalist companies. I mean, whether you look at Apple or Android or any of them, I'm pretty confident in saying that there is a huge footprint of open source software that underpins the technologies that we all use and think of as Apple, Android, and all the other sort of capital companies.
So something you said there really caught my attention, and it was that these tens of thousands or possibly hundreds of thousands of developers working independently but also collaboratively to create WordPress or, you know, things like Linux or possibly Wikipedia, they don't have to have full consensus in order to do work that builds something that is of use to a lot of people. You don't have to build total consensus. You can have people working on this project who don't share a common vision, at least, you know, not one that is in complete harmony. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. So on the purely development side, listeners may have heard the term version control or Git or GitHub or things like that. Whether it's whatever version control tool, the way the development tends to happen is that there might be features that certain groups want to build. There might be bugs that other people would really like to see fixed. And individuals can work on those, and they'll work in a sort of separate branch on the code, or they might test a particular branch that has that feature. One of the more recent ones on the WordPress side was a REST API that, digesting the technical side of it, really is setting up to allow a WordPress site talk to other sites through sort of a programming interface. That wasn't something that initially the very core parts of the sort of WordPress group who organized it or started out building WordPress, I should say, thought was necessarily the next most important thing to work on. But there was hundreds of developers who did. And so they worked on that feature in a separate branch, tested it, got it to the point where it was at a functional state to be them saying, we think this is ready to be contributed back to this core of WordPress. And they then had to have, you know, sort of the discussions of, is that ready? And it changed a lot of the conversation, if I compare it to sort of government-based things, from ideological sort of talking about ideas to the concrete example of code to say, we think this is ready. If you, another group says, maybe the guardians to the core version control piece, if you don't think that this is ready, tell us at a detailed area where it's not, so we can either correct those technical pieces, or we can continue the conversation to say why that may or may not need to be the case. It's a very pragmatic approach to large scale problems, because it moves past the idea of like, what's your philosophy, to send me a code example of what you're trying to do or contribute the code to where you would like to see the project go. And the conversation moves forward. From my perspective, you know, I may like to see a particular feature developed. I may not have the time and resources to get to it, but if I see that there's others out there who want to see that feature develop, I get the benefit of it by them working on it, which is in large contrast to sort of closed source models of development that are much more the company sets the direction for what they want the platform to go. And I, as a consumer of that platform, have very little say in what that direction is or when they achieve those goals.
So we're talking about spaceships and turning the human species into a multi-planet species. And so far we've specified, you know, we've looked specifically at Elon Musk and his business SpaceX and their ambitions and the milestones that they've already passed. We are talking about democracy and the organization of humans and human action and doing that in a way that is fair and respects people's differences of opinion, but at the same time doesn't get bogged down in a fruitless search for total consensus. And I've also mentioned just in passing, and this is all from a correspondence that we had last night on Facebook Messenger, video games. So how do video games tie into these topics that we've been talking about?
The visual side of it that connected to the Elon Musk was the graphics that they showed on the screen, mapping back to sort of what I remember about Master of Orion or some of those older games. But I think the area where it could be interesting to explore the idea is maybe I'll try and weave in one more narrative that was your last episode and see if this makes sense or might just muddy the waters a little bit more. You were looking at the idea of culture and the idea that there's a recycling process that's happening where, you know, TV shows and media from our childhood are getting a new fresh coat of paint and just trying to not necessarily focus everybody on that version of culture, but it's, I look at that as it's kind of like we're driving from the rearview mirror. We see what worked in the past or what people liked in the past, and they're recycling it forward to the future. So I wonder if in terms of the idea of game mechanics, maybe if online games where people have votes or points to choose what the direction of the goal of the game is, if we can kind of look at how people participate or where they participate and express their interest as a proxy for the things that they would like to see manifest into future reality. And, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that idea of the secret in that, which is sort of put your intentions out into the world and they manifest. But it's, if we don't have the democracy-based tools that in the current structure to let people vote at that scale of what their interests are, maybe there's mechanics from games that can be a proxy for that. So we're able to say, you know, look at how many people are interested in having either free energy or certainly less polluting energy. How many people are interested in, and in a SimCity type fashion, build an environment where it is much more equitable. That should give our policymakers a better sense of those are the areas where we would actually like to see them direct time, effort, and materials towards achieving.
So if I were to ask you to say that in using one third as many words as you just did, would you give that a try?
Sure. How can we have games or other forms of media that are participatory that allow others to see the areas where we are playing in the game and invested in the game and interests shown within that game should be representative of the direction that we set for society as a whole.
And you mentioned that this was a line of thought that was sparked by a recent episode of mine. I want to tell people that's an episode of the C-Realm Vault podcast. So it was not on last week's C-Realm radio. And so if they don't recognize the topic, it's not that their memories are faulty or they weren't following the podcast or the broadcast. It's just they haven't heard the actual thing that you're referencing, which is fine. Gives me an opportunity to mention that I do have a weekly podcast that I do, which is behind a paywall. So it is the most dedicated and generous of listeners who get to hear that material. I want to play something right now. This is from a different science fiction-based video game. It's very similar to Master of Orion. It's a little bit newer, but it's from the previous century. But, well, I'm just going to play it right now, and then I'll talk about it afterwards. Here we go.
The ancient Chinese had a name for it, feng shui. We call it energy flow. It is the same thing, the same thought. Energy is everywhere, but only a fraction of it is tapped by humans for their purposes. Now the progenitors have taught us that we can tap not only our own latent abilities, but the latent abilities of the universe itself. Prophet Cha Dawn, Planet Rising.
Did you recognize that?
I did not, unfortunately. No.
Ah, that's from the video game Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri. So it's from the same game designer as the original Civilization and its many subsequent iterations. And it was a really compelling game. It was like Master of Orion in that you are controlling a civilization, but it all takes place on one planet, a spaceship from Earth. A colony ship goes to this other planet, this Earth-like planet, and it crash lands. But the various survivors of the crash landing organize themselves according to the different ideological factions that they were grouped with on the ship. And so those are the different competing, whereas in Civilization you'd have, say the English or the Americans or the Mongols or the Japanese. In this you have, the capitalists and the tech people and the religious people. And then you have a sort of Chinese hive mind type group and... It's very fascinating. And to me, some of the best science fiction narratives that look to a far future multi-worlds sort of arrangement, of the human species, come in the form of video games. Because in these big video games where you're not an individual, running around with a gun like in Grand Theft Auto or something, but you are the sort of god emperor of a society as it evolves over centuries, you can get... a sort of overview of a civilization from a science fiction perspective that doesn't have to be portrayed from the perspective of a protagonist running around, in a sort of hero's journey loop. You can get a more of a god's eye view, which is really fascinating. I mean, thousands, millions of people have played these games and they have just in the process of playing a game and pursuing a goal in the game had to grapple with all of these really meaty science fiction-like conventions and tropes. And, I don't want to say tropes because that makes it sound like it's really hackneyed and trivial, and it's not. I mean, some things that you really have to delve into some hard science fiction literature to get at any place else, you can get in games.
The thing that I connect in hearing that is the idea that, you can run through hundreds of years of a civilization in that game and look at what impact does a particular decision or policy have as you extrapolate out into the future. And the idea of games as a simulation engine allow us to explore some of the different policies because it's easier to say, if it's relatively speaking modeled on reality enough that what you simulate gives you valuable data on the other side. If someone wants to say, what would a world like look like without money? Well, they could model that. You can try different games out of that, and you can see, is there good things that come out of that that, based on the number of iterations, would be worthwhile applying to our current society? Or how does that change the conversation by having hard data to actually back up some of those what-if scenarios?
Something that I learned from the very first, civics simulation game I ever played, which was SimCity, was that the more roads you build, the more traffic congestion you get. And people get unhappy, it creates pollution, it creates all manner of social problems. But I didn't believe that SimCity was a thoroughgoing enough simulation to really trust that, that is an emergent property of building roads. It could be that it's a deliberate lesson built into the simulation. And so one has to wonder, how much propaganda is there built into the simulation that you're playing?
Looking at what developers' assumptions are is a hard problem, regardless of it being a simulation game or dealing with accessibility or just we all have our own internal biases, and your coding some of those assumptions into a game or a platform, whether you realize it or not. And that's, you know, another challenge to add to the mix of how do we ensure that what we're setting as policy, and we think, you know, quote unquote, we, as I've been saying here, is something that's good for the whole of society. And that's that. I don't have great answers on that. I just know it's something that I keep coming back to having questions about, and I'm like seeing examples like Elon Musk's vision where, you know, if in 5 to 10 years we're at the point where we are a multi-planetary species, I look at that as a very, very good thing.
Say more about that.
In what way?
Well, to say that, you know, it would be a good thing to be a multi-planetary species, you know, there's the don't put all your eggs in one basket thing. I hear that a lot from, you know, people like at the Lifeboat Foundation and various techno-utopians who understand that there are events that can basically destroy life on Earth pretty quickly and kill off the human species if we don't exist anyplace else. But, you know, there are counter-arguments which say that, look, this is the best planet in the solar system in terms of supporting life. We need to really, you know, we should put all of our eggs in one basket and take very good care of this basket. And the idea that we are going to put humanity on different planets in order to have a sort of backup plan B if things go wrong here is wrongheaded. We really need to make sure that things go right here. That should be our, not only our first priority, but our primary and possibly only priority in terms of, you know, where humanity exists and how our civilization spreads, you know, over, you know, away from the cradle of life on this planet.
Maybe the thought that comes to mind, and that is, what if the process of, excuse me, building rockets and getting us to become a multi-planetary species leads to that we have more energy efficient engines, and certainly looking at the wider work that Elon Musk has done, electric cars, solar power is reducing the footprint that humans have on our first planet of Earth. I think if the byproduct of getting to be a multi-planetary species is technology that helps ensure our life on Earth is sustainable and has the least amount of impact and also leads to a quality of life from that, I think that's a net win. So if it isn't harming the wider population to have those who want to try and make the humanity multi-planetary, let those people encourage them and, you know, see what happens as a result.
Right. And it's definitely not an either or sort of thing. You know, either we do right by planet Earth or we look for someplace else to go. And we can pursue many priorities and many destinations at once. Not everybody's going to be interested in the same things. If you have been listening to the C-Realm podcast for any length of time, you know that I interview people like John Michael Greer, who likes to make Elon Musk his particular whipping boy. You know, he describes him as a subsidy dumpster king, by which he means none of Elon Musk's businesses would be economically viable if it weren't for the fact that they were all subsidized by the U.S. federal government, including his electric car business, and certainly his space business as well. In fact, some of the early money-making milestones and objectives for SpaceX is to be able to take payloads up to the International Space Station and dock with it. And, you know, that's not anything you can do, and it's not anything you can get paid to do, were it not for the fact that various national governments around the world have poured a lot of resources into creating what looks to me to be a very modest endeavor in space, which is the International Space Station.
That it is true. He's found a business model that allows him to achieve his other goals, while in service to sort of the capitalist culture, or maybe as John Michael Greer might say, that's his only goal. But I still have enough optimism in sort of the techno-optimist that I don't necessarily see it that way.
Yeah, I don't really either, but I'm just representing John Michael Greer here. But there's a lot of people listening, you know, who they associate the C-Realm podcast and now C-Realm Radio with a skeptical view of the grand visions painted by people like Elon Musk, you know, the techno-utopians. And I have definitely been a representative of that extreme form of even adversarial skepticism to, you know, techno-utopian viewpoints. And I'm starting to chafe against that now. I'm starting to come around, not necessarily to being a person who thinks that all of our problems will be solved through the application of technology, but certainly somebody who is willing to listen to what the techno-utopians are proposing with an open mind, you know, in a fair-minded way, and not just waiting for my turn to talk so I can heap scorn on them.
Let me put a question to you in that regards. That was one of the other things I noticed following watching that video. The hurricanes that had affected Puerto Rico have very much ravaged their power, cell phone, basically everything. The Powerwall adapter from the other companies, Elon has donated a bunch of those to Puerto Rico. And what it got me thinking about was the idea that in the short term, being devastated by that natural disaster is obviously problematic for Puerto Rico. Is there an upside that comes from having a bit of a clean slate to be able to build out of the gate with solar panels and environmentally friendly technologies that other countries which have existing infrastructure are a little bit more handcuffed by? So that it kind of says, if you were starting today from a clean slate, would you still feel as concerned about sort of that technological mindset as it is one where we're living in the infrastructure of the fossil fuels and everything that has gotten us up to this point?
Well, obviously, it really sucks to have your house flattened by a hurricane and to have the power be out for weeks, if not months, and to have to worry about, you know, the bacteria in your drinking water and whether or not you're going to get cholera. I mean, all of this is a catastrophe on the individual scale in the short term. But collectively, yeah, Puerto Rico faces an opportunity right now and a danger. There were cities in Japan that were just bombed and firebombed to just obliterated, really, in World War II. And when they rebuilt on a grid system with really wide boulevards to accommodate, you know, lots of traffic. And they rebuilt in a way that they absolutely could not have built if they were just, you know, revamping their city piecemeal over the course of decades. You know, you have to respect what's there. You have to build with what you have. And when everything is taken from you and you have a blank canvas, then you can do something new. And you know, possibly do something in the case of Puerto Rico, you can have a variety of different localized, you know, energy input and energy generation structures that can fuel innovation and can provide a testing ground and a demonstration of different ways of doing things. But at the same time, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure from people in power to reconstruct the former dysfunctional, you know, top-down centralized power structure or power grid in Puerto Rico. So there is a momentary, you know what, I'm going to stop talking and turn off my mic until this train passes. Why don't you pick it up from here?
Sure. There was another thing that brought to mind was, I can't remember who had talked about it, but the idea that either Britain after World War II, having all of their copper phone lines bombed out, was able to jumpstart a little bit towards cellular because of the fact that they didn't have that common platform to go from. And the other example that was right along those lines was that in Africa, credits for using your cell phone minutes have become a bit of a system of currency because people could trade them almost as freely as cash, but they had a common good. So it wasn't necessarily, there are detriments to where they are now and losing that train of thought, unfortunately. But just the idea that when you have a bit more of a blank slate, you have an opportunity to take the lessons learned from society and the shared knowledge that we have up to this point and build forward from there. And one of the episodes, I think in a C-Realm past that you had interviewed, and I know I did on my defunct podcast, was some of the people from the Seasteading Institute. And it was because it really took that idea that maybe connects back to open source to say, if you have an idea for how a group of people should be able to live with autonomy in their sort of geographic bubble, they wanted to build ships or retrofit cruise ships or any other platform to be able to make that experiment and see what is good or bad that comes about from it. But the contrast they run into is there isn't many areas or any areas on land where you don't already have some sort of a geographic government. So it's hard to set up those experiments. And that's why seasteading was looking at using the international waters as the area to incubate those potential ideas.
So I'm familiar with seasteading or the notion of it. I don't think I've interviewed anybody who's officially involved with it. But the criticism that, you know, I get from, and anytime I mention the idea, particularly on social media, somebody will snap back with some sort of vague accusation that what the people who want to get away from, you know, the sphere of control that national governments exude is probably up to something really nefarious and no good. I mean, they want to do something which is illegal, and most things that are illegal for good reason. What's your response to that?
That may well be the case. I think similar to Elon Musk and the idea of multiplanetary species, if what they're doing isn't impacting others on a sort of macro level, and there is sufficient information about what they're doing, so it's not like, you know, they're running prison camps, but on the front side of it, everything looks like it's a warm and fuzzy picture, but that there's good communication of information, lessons learned, I say let them run that experiment.
So that sounds maybe a bit heartless to the people who are, you know, the prisoners in the prison camp.
Yeah, and that's where maybe there needs to be a different set of policies as far as if somebody wants to set up a new nation state or seastead or whatever, what are the base criteria that you have to agree to meet? Kind of like the UN standards are supposed to be representative for levels that all governments agree to uphold, but some vary further than that than others.
We blew right past the half hour mark where I should have announced to folks that you're listening to WOOL 91.5 in Bellows Falls. This is Sea Realm Radio. I'm your host, KMO. I'm speaking with Jamie, who is a longtime friend of the Sea Realm, and he's somebody who's very interested in the regular Sea Realm topics, but somebody who is definitely closer to the techno-optimist end of the spectrum of people who listen to the Sea Realm. A lot of people I know will be pretty impatient at a lot of the conversation we've been having, but one of those people is definitely not Larry Lowe. Larry Lowe has been a guest on this program, and as far as I know, he's listening right now because he has been posting comments to the Friends of the Sea Realm, and I'm going to read just a few of those now, and we can pick and choose which ones we want to respond to. Larry writes, "How do you pay for his vision, his being Elon Musk's vision of Mars access, you ask? Use the core of it to create a true space liner. 30-minute flight time to anywhere meaningful on the other side of the planet with more pressurized cargo capacity, I guess it is, volume than an A380, which is an enormous military cargo plane. That would disrupt the air-breathing, winged, very long-range commercial transport industry." So what Larry's talking about here is something that you mentioned, the same rocket technology that Elon Musk is proposing to get humans to Mars and to take a lot of cargo and enough fuel into orbit to get us to Mars, can also be used to move people, say, from New York City to Beijing in about a half hour's time. And, you know, to me, the idea that we can get from New York City to Beijing in a day is pretty remarkable. And that the people, you know, having to endure a day in airports and on a plane, you know, to get from one side of the world to the other, that's not a whole lot to ask. I mean, it's pretty miraculous as it is. So to me, the idea that, you know, there will be a class of people who can afford to go from New York to Beijing in half an hour is not necessarily a great boon to humanity. It doesn't strike me that this is the sort of technology which is going to be cheap enough that it will be a factor in the lives of most people, and certainly not enough people will be able to afford that to disrupt the conventional air travel as I see it now. Do you think I'm wrong in my assumptions there?
Not at all. I think what it might open the door, though, is if that long-distance travel, and I don't know whether that is more sending a rocket into space and then back down. What's the environmental impact of that in comparison to running airplanes across, from Tokyo to New York? But I think if there was a way that, regardless of the cost of it, perhaps, how can we have the environmental impact have a weight that helps us decide what are the things that either could be or not could be created, but should be invested in, and that environmental cost is factored into the transit. So if it is, much more environmentally friendly for the rocket method, then is there it leads down like carbon tax and that sort of thing for the existing infrastructure. But just getting us to the idea that I share a lot more of the concerns that you have in terms of techno-optimism than maybe this conversation has brought forward so far. But I just want to see what is the best thing that we can do to allow society to stay healthy on this planet, move freely, have opportunity to try as many different experiments as they want, and what are the ways that we can go about trying to get that. And so far, Elon's example is one of the best I've seen, where he's saying, I've managed to bootstrap and jumpstart from the capitalism platform, and he's trying to make his version of that come about.
Larry also wanted to stress that Elon Musk is working on a fuel tank for the rockets, which is made out of very light materials. I think it's carbon fiber. Larry's describing it as carbon mesh. And this is part of the BFR, or the big FN rocket. He also writes, he is, in fact, driving space access to an unprecedented level of affordability. And yeah, definitely the price for getting into space is coming down, largely thanks to the efforts of Elon Musk and SpaceX and other private space businesses. And also Larry writes, so what would open source democracy look like? So that's part of the technology of video games being bootstrapped up into actual meaningful organization of human activity in society. What would that look like?
I'm not 100% sure, even maybe 5% sure. One of the things that in development I've enjoyed watching over the years is that there tends to be a bit of a pendulum between centralized platforms and technologies to more decentralized ones. So the web has kind of gone through that ebb and flow. And with democracy, I think we've seen at small scale, the idea that you can have individual autonomy and decentralized control, but we haven't really seen experiments at the macro scale. One of the ones that I was just looking up that could be a interesting starting point to some of that is the website's Loomio.org, Loomio.org. And I've read up a little bit on them. I think they had started or came about with the idea back in Zuccotti Park in New York. And their goal is, just reading a little bit from it, is saving time, giving clear outcomes, and keeping everything out in the open in one place. And while their targets are sort of boards and committees to make decisions and cooperative groups, a lot of what I read from their site is maybe a template or a starting point for that idea of open source democracy. The challenge I always stumble in when I think deeper into this is, how do you ensure that whoever's voting for that initiative is a part of that group in whatever term you want to define that? And even in existing government, that's often come up as a question or a narrative of late. But it's, I think The challenge is if it's truly distributed democracy, it's only going to affect your individual area. And open source and the web and development technologies have really changed the idea that geography is the, it certainly still is a primary thing, but if, you know, across all of North America, 70% of people would really like to see police not be responsible for policing certain activities. But when you look at voting on the small area, that may not come about. I think maybe a more centralized set of tools that allow people to share what their interests are and it's captured in a useful fashion might be a good step in that direction.
Going back to Larry's comments, he has corrected me. I said that the A380 was a military transport plane. Actually, what I think I was thinking of there is something like the C5M Super Galaxy or the C-17 Globemaster. Larry let me know that the A380 is actually the Airbus equivalent of the Boeing 747, and that Elon Musk is claiming that the economics of air travel using his technology would have a ticket price being roughly the same as it is for standard commercial jet travel right now, which is hard to imagine. But if it were true, then it probably would disrupt the standard air travel mechanisms. And it would probably then really be necessary to figure out how this new sort of suborbital flight affects the environment in comparison to the environmental impacts of, you know, commercial air travel now. Because most of the flight time is going to be above the atmosphere, it seems that there's a possibility that the impacts would be lowered, although it could be that, you know, so much thrust and so much fuel is expended on takeoff and landing that, you know, it offsets the fact that it's out of the atmosphere. But also, we're talking about a 30-minute flight time rather than a 13, 14, maybe 15-hour flight time to get from North America to certain parts of Asia.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And 5 years, when you think about, like, Kickstarter starting maybe less than a decade ago, 5 years is not a long time. Obviously, their goal in that was only having sent a few rockets to Mars and proving out the technology for it. So maybe his estimates are wildly optimistic and it's 10 to 15. But I'm curious where we are now in terms of either technology for travel or sort of general society. How long do you feel like it's been since we've had a fundamental shift other than maybe cell phones is the one that I look at and point to as being a radical change over the last sort of 10 years?
I don't see anything really. I mean, we're in terms of travel, you know, transportation via train, cars, buses, airplanes. It doesn't seem to have changed much in a very long time, you know, much longer than the last decade.
Yeah.
So, hey, we are down to just a couple minutes. So, now I think it's safe for me to ask you if you have seen either the new Star Trek show or the Orville, and now the conversation can't run out of control.
I have seen both of those, actually.
Any thoughts?
I think right now I like the Orville better. It reminds me a little bit more of Star Trek: The Next Generation, which I was also a large fan of. I'm giving Star Trek a few more episodes that I hope it could be just their narrative way into this reboot that has the concerns that you hadn't pointed out in the last episode, or the one that I was listening to perhaps. It doesn't surprise me though that narrative comes across from CBI or CBS, which I would call like the common narrative of NCIS and all their crime dramas and procedurals and stuff. Star Trek fits into that ethos surprisingly well when they've rebooted it the way they have.
The second episode of the pilot ends with the main character, Michael Burnham, played by Sinequa Martin-Green, basically being sentenced to life imprisonment in what looks like a secret military tribunal with no witnesses in attendance and the three-judge panel, they're speaking in shadow. You can't see their faces. It was all very sinister and not at all in keeping with, you know, the future of humanity in space and cooperatively interacting with alien species that we see in the old Star Trek.
Yeah, that's very true. It had a certainly grim coat of paint on it at this point.
All right. Well, as I say, I waited to the very end to raise this, so we couldn't go on for half an hour about it. I have a few notifications that I need to read out to the listeners. So at this point, I'll have to let you go. But Jamie, thanks so much for being such a longtime friend of the Sea Realm and for stepping in on very short notice to have this conversation on air.
Happy to help, and I hope that the other Sea Realmers enjoyed some of it.
I'm sure they did. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you again.
Cheers.
All right, that is all for this episode of Sea Realm Radio. Thanks so much for listening. I will talk to you again in 1 week's time.
Think globally, listen locally. This is Black Sheep Radio, WOOL-FM, 91.5 Bellows Falls, community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.